This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. Thank y'all for coming out. Today's topic is intellectual property and piracy. What we're going to do tonight is somewhat of a variant of a class that I gave like 10 years ago. It's the first time I looked into it when I was still a rabbinical student. In a past life, I was a computer science person. So the question of, you know, software piracy was huge. Music piracy was huge. I don't know how old you guys are. Y'all remember Napster?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know it, Pio. I remember Napster. Like, my nephew, when he was two, you'd ask him, like, where do we get the music from? And he'd say, Napster.com. It was so adorable. And, yeah, partially legal. But one of the questions that come up is, what exactly is the role of such things in halacha? What does Jewish law have to say about intellectual property? And, you know, it's one of the things where people intuitively want to say that Jewish law prohibits it. But you can't really just do that. You need to figure out why exactly is it prohibited. And there are a couple of ways that people have, you know, come around this. One of the, I guess, you know, bigger issues that, well, I shouldn't say this, one of the original issues where it came up in Jewish law, even though things like software and music piracy are, you know, relatively new things, the matter of intellectual property is something quite old. In the Jewish world, it was a big part of the publishing world, meaning if you had a manuscript and you set the typesetting, that was a great deal of intellectual property. Once you have that out, anyone could just as easily copy your typesetting, right? Or other things along the publishing world of, you know, such duplications. And then, you know, you had people that wanted to try to protect these works because, you know, someone puts in, and people would give the same type of logic that you heard the, like, recording industry or Motion Picture Association of America, you know, would say, like, well, if you, you know, don't protect the intellectual property, then no one's going to create. So, too, you know, if you don't protect the work of someone who puts in so much effort to do the typesetting, no one's going to do it. But is that really a halachic, you know, argument? There are two arguments that are given in the literature that we're not going to focus on today because, for our purposes, they're kind of cop-outs. One of them is Dina del Malchuta Dina, which is Aramaic for meaning the law of the land is the law. And there are, you know, individuals say, well, you know, given that American copyright law is X, then that means you as a Jew following Dina del Malchuta Dina can't violate it. But the reason why I say that's a cop-out is that it would be complete. I mean, one, I have a whole separate shiur. It'll take about at least an hour to go through what is that concept of the law of the land is the law, and has that fit in the whole Jewish legal system. But also, deciphering the American law, copyright law, is really complicated. And it's hotly contested, questions about fair use, what agreements are valid and invalid. But also, you know, more to the point, is that it's not really a Jewish argument. Saying, oh, you have to follow the civil, you know, government. But, like, let's say you live in a place like, say, I think Sealand. You guys know about Sealand? Sealand's a wacky place. It's off the coast of England. You know, I mean, it's off the coast of England. I believe it's on an old military base that's technically and legally its own country. And you have, like, servers there that people, you know, put stuff on because their laws are a lot more lax and no one can go and enforce anything because that's where the big computers are. And let's say you go to the Cayman Islands. Right, you've got, or offshore stuff, like you've got, you know, the online gambling, you know, all of those servers are outside of the U.S., right? So let's say you go to, you know, you're Jewish, you happen to live in the Cayman Islands, lucky you, right? Are you still, so Dina de Malchuta Dina might not apply. If you're listening, by the way, I have no idea what the Cayman Islands laws are. Let's assume they've got no laws about intellectual property, right? Yeah. So would you still be allowed to do it by Jewish law, right? So it only answers, like, part of the question. So practically in America, yeah, you could say Dina de Malchuta, and that'll be a whole long discussion, but that doesn't really hold of Jewish law. Another one is, what people used to do is when someone published a sefer, you know, a Torah book, they would have, like, a certain approbation at the very beginning saying, you can't reproduce this for a certain amount of time, right? But that's less, right? And happy birthday.
Thank you.
Facebook is very useful
Facebook
for that.
Is fantastic.
Yeah.
time a few minutes late. Hello.
Yeah, we're just doing an introduction part here about the questions, and you explained how goal is to try to figure out what does Jewish law have to say about intellectual property and piracy, discounting Dina Dilmachuta Dina, because it's not, one, it's a huge complicated topic, and two, it doesn't really mean that's part of the Jewish side. You're relying on the secular law. And the other, you know, cop-out, kind of, is when rabbis, you know, would put on these little, you know, disclaimers, almost like the modern-day EULA, saying, like, you can't do certain things with this book for X number of years. But that's not really intrinsically halachic. That's an individual rabbi who's saying, this is what you can or can't do with something. But, you know, where does any, whoever the rabbi happens to be, whatever halachic authority he has is actually something we talk about in the Sunday class. But that's basically a way of saying, like, I don't want you to do it. But that doesn't mean that it's intrinsic into Jewish law. All right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to see, I mean, the way that we're going to try to approach this, and we'll do some introductory stuff, and the way I'll try to do it is, what could it possibly fall under? And we'll see what some of the issues are with that. Meaning, whenever you want to say, and this is a very important point, whenever you have any halachic discussion, if anyone tells you you can't do something, it is asur, and uses that term asur, meaning forbidden, the burden is on that person to explain why it is asur de oraita, why it is forbidden biblically, or asur de rabbanan, forbidden rabbinically, and provide a source to justify how that fits. Okay? And that's what we're going to try to do here. The problem with something like intellectual property and things like MP3s or any other sort of, you know, infringement, you're dealing with things that Chazal couldn't possibly have fathomed. And it's a question that comes up whenever you have any technical innovation that didn't exist in rabbinic times, is what existing laws on the books are most parallel. All right? So let's start us off with some introductory things just about, you know, intellectual property. You start us off with, you just read the English. If you don't want to read, you can just pass. Sure. So sources 1A and 1B.
1A and 1B.
Yeah, because normally they're separate. I put A's and B's when they really, you know, two sources really
sure.
go together.
So it's 1A and B, Megillah?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first is Megillah 15A. Yeah.
Right, that's the one you want me to read, right?
Yes.
Okay. So this Rabbi Eleazar further said in the name of Rabbi Hanina, whoever reports a saying in the name of its originator brings deliverance to the world, as it says, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai.
Okay, and the next one?
Rabbi Jose.
The translations here are copied and pasted from Cincino, so some of the English can come across a little bit weird. It's just easier for me to copy paste than
For whosoever reports a thing in the name of him that said it brings deliverance into the world, as it is said, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai.
Alright, so in Hebrew it's Ha'omer Davar Kol Ha'omer Davar B'Shem Omro Meviku Ula Ola Olam. It's a citation a lot of people like to throw out to sound from, which means, you know, if you say something in the name of the person who said it, you bring redemption to the world. What makes this so hilarious is, well, very few people know who actually said that. Right? I mean, if you ask, like, most people who will cite this don't know the people in whose name it's said. And two, you'll notice something interesting about who actually said this line.
Esther.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's not Esther who said it. It's based off of the verse in Esther, right? Because Batomer Esther Lamelch B'Shem Mordechai is the verse on which it's based, where Esther goes to the king and cites Mordechai by name, and that ultimately brought, you know, redemption, you know, the whole story. We'll get there in a couple of months, right? But in terms of this statement, Kol HaOmer Davar B'Shem Omro, right? Whoever reports something in the name of the originator, who is the one who said that?
Hanina? Originally.
That's one, and the other is Rabbi Yossi.
Yes.
Meaning you have on this, you know, exact line that's talking about citing something in the original, meaning giving appropriate credit to someone, you actually have a bit of a variant as to who was the one who actually said it.
Right.
Well, also, like, he said it b'shem. Like, to be
right. Honest. So Rav Elazar, great pickup.
Yeah.
So Rav Elazar, in fact, cited it in someone's name and the name from which he, or at least it could have been the way, you know, from whom he heard it.
Yeah.
there's nothing contradicting Rabbi Yossi from hearing it from some other source and it being cited elsewhere, right? But it does, you know, you sort of like get to see a little, at least a little bit of the problem. And the truth is the Gemara is chock full of questionable attributions. You've got Ika de Amris, meaning some will say, you'll have a source that says, you know, someone says X, and others say someone else said it, right? So even, how you doing? Okay, nice little digression there. So here, though, right?
I'm Aaron.
Quoting
Josh.
Hi. Sorry. Good to see you. I'm Laura. We've met before.
Yeah. So quoting something in someone's name isn't, in this point, considered a requirement, right? It seems optional, but also what you'd call a really good thing. Sarah, now that you're with us for today, could you read in the English sources 2A and 2B? 2A is Proverbs 6:30, and 2B is a Tosefta Bava Kamma 7:13 that's a teaching based off of the verse in Proverbs. Go, read, yeah.
Okay, so Proverbs 6:30. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his hunger when he is starving.
The Tosefta. Tosefta is Tannaitic, meaning it's around the same time period as the Mishnah. So it's that, you know, time period of rabbinic material, but it didn't quite make the cut to make it in the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. All right?
Tosefta, Bava Kamma. But someone who steals, the Torah teachings, from his fellow and goes and teaches, even though he is called a thief, he merits it himself.
So here, it's a very interesting line. It's if you pass off your own teaching, you know, you're stealing other people's teaching, you pass it off on your own. According to this Tosefta, afal pishe nikra ganav, you're actually called a thief. It's a very unusual type of passage there. Right? So how would you think you'd be considered a thief?
Plagiarism.
So you say plagiarism. Explain.
Well, it says here, who steals Torah teachings.
Right. Well, the Torah teachings is in, you know, the black bracket theory.
So that could be listening to somebody giving a shiur or something and passing it off as his own, just like copying a paper from the internet.
Right. So, well, in a sense, yes. There's something called genevat da'at, which means...
stealing knowledge.
Right. So what does stealing knowledge mean?
I mean, I guess not giving the credit to the person you took it from.
Yes. And what's the problem with not giving credit?
Because you pretend it's yours.
Bingo. When you pretend something is yours, what genevat da'at, stealing of knowledge, means is effectively misleading someone. Right? If I teach something in my own name and I don't give attribution, right, you would think it's like, oh, this is what he said. Right? Now, it is theoretically possible that two people come up with the same idea independently. That does happen. But it's also not uncommon for someone to just randomly take ideas. Although, to quote Rav Tendler, he said, the only difference between a chiddush, meaning an innovative Torah concept or idea, and plagiarism is a bad memory. Right? Because sometimes, like, you know, you'll go, you'll listen to a class, you won't really pay attention, and it's like, oh, great, brilliant idea, right? Which isn't exactly the same type of thing. But there are, I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who takes someone else's teachings and passes them off on their own. So in terms of, even though you're called a ganav, right, the type of theft that you're doing isn't necessarily, you know, when you talk about geneva da'at, the theft you're talking about isn't, like, here's a specific example. Let's say I hear a shiur from Rav Soloveitchik. A lot of his stuff online now, listen to a shiur. And I was like, hey, that's a great idea. I'm going to use it. Mm-hmm. What's the theft being done in terms of geneva da'at? It's not really me stealing from Rav Soloveitchik as much as me stealing your knowledge of, or at least not knowledge, but me stealing your impression of me. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's a different type of geneva in this particular case here in terms of what the theft is. Right? But still relevant for us. The biggest issue that we deal with is summed up nicely in Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat 2031. Laura, could you read that one in English?
And anything which has no substance cannot actually be acquired. For example, if one acquired that one would walk with someone to a particular place, or to divide a shared courtyard between them and the like. These are acquisitions of things which there is nothing to apply.
Right. So in plain, more simple English,
if there's nothing tangible.
Yes. Like MP3s, right, halachically don't exist. Right? You're talking about...
But that's a tangible file. It's a file.
You try reaching in and picking out a file. A file, it by definition is intangible. A physical CD, if I go to Tower Records,
because you can't hold it.
CDs, you know, I can buy a CD. What I can't buy are the bytes of information.
Okay.
Right? I download stuff, those are just bytes being transferred. Halakhically, they don't exist. Oh. So that makes it really complicated, and that's effectively what intellectual property is. Right. You're not about copywriting. It's things that aren't physical, right? Okay. Yeah. So now let's go into the meat. What are some possibilities of Jewish laws on the books that you might be able to fit in intellectual property into? And we'll see, does it work or does it not work? You do, first one is... So the first one is simply theft. This is responsive from Orach Chaim 440, subsection 19, written in 1978-79, something like that.
Okay. But to make another tape from one tape without permission is prohibited because of theft.
Pretty simple, straightforward. This is part of a much longer response, and he writes about if someone makes a recording of Divrei Torah and passing them out, but here in one very simple sentence, if you read in the Hebrew, he actually transliterates tape as Tet Yud Yud Pei. Rav Moshe does that a lot, and sometimes you have to like actually sound out the words to figure out, like, he transliterates cards. Cars, you know, automobiles. Mm-hmm. He writes, it's difficult. But anyway, so he writes tapes. All right, for those who are young, tapes were these little things, that digital, you know, magnetic strips that, there's actually was a meme going around of a picture of one of those, of a tape and a pencil, and then said, you know, if you were born after a certain year, you don't know how these two things go together. Anyway, he's very clear here, right, that copying one tape from another tape is gezel. Isur gezel is his term. Is it theft? All right. So he says it's theft. Does that hold up? Well, what's the halachic definition of theft? Truth is, there are two categories of theft in Jewish law. One is called gezela, the other called geneva. Right? So he actually says it's isur gezel. So we'll start off with the isur gezel. And here I want to use Rambam's definition because he sums it up very nicely. This is in the laws of Gzela and Aveda 1:3. Who is this gozel? Meaning, what is the person who is called a gozel? What is this act of gezel? This is one who takes someone else's money by force, such as grabbing something from his hand or entering his property without his permission and took vessels from there, or that he attacked his servants and his animals and used them, or he went down to his field and ate his fruits, and these sorts of things are considered theft. As it is discussed, he snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hands and killed him with his own spear. So it's a type of thing you would call this, in plain English, a mugging. And the verse here cited, the Gemara cites this verse, just as, you know, this idiom here is, you're holding a spear, I take the spear from you and I kill you with it. That is a type of gezel. It is a brazen, straight-up public type of stealing. On the second hand, you've got something called geneva, which is described as Rambam in Geneva 1:3. In fact, the very beginning of Gzela Neveda and geneva are almost, you know, identical parallels. And they're effectively the same subject matter with, you know, some differences. But who is the ganav? This is someone who takes someone else's money in secret without the owner's knowledge. For example, someone who puts his hand in someone else's bag, I can't type, and takes money from it, the owner does not see, and all things similar. But if he took the money in the open or in public with force, he is not a ganav but a goslin. In short, a ganav is someone who steals surreptitiously, goes in your house in the cover of night, steals your money. A goslin is much more upfront and open about it. So, question is, let's say, using Rav Moshe's definition of copying one tape to another tape, does this fit either definition of either a ganav or a goslin? Now remember, Rav Moshe specifically said goslin, you know, isur gezel. Does this fit? Why or why not?
Well, I would assume, and this is just an assumption, but if he's taking one tape and making it into another tape, one would think that he's doing it to play or to give to other people, which would be like a public kind of a thing. So
he's just making it for himself.
If he's just speaking to himself, why is he copying it from one tape to another?
So you're harping. Interesting. So you guys are harping on the how it's actually done. Meaning most people don't copy tapes in public. Like, they don't do it in Times Square. You do it from the privacy of your own house.
Right, well, that's not even what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, if he's taking one tape and he's copying it to another tape, I would assume that since he's doing that to play the tape for others. In other words, if he was just playing it... I don't know.
Interesting.
I copy tapes from the library.
So if I'm getting it, your argument isn't in the act of stealing, but what is he going to do with this?
With the information, right.
Interesting. Doesn't seem to be, you know, in terms of the act, I mean, he seems to say that the actual act of... And when you say what is the stealing part, though, it would be the taping.
The actual act,
not
right.
In terms of the playback, you know, without the express written consent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the taping itself, I would think, would definitely seems to fall more under a secretive thing, more like a gun of. I mean, right,
okay.
Like you were saying before, you're not going to do it in the middle of Times Square. It's just weird.
All right. Now, here's where the big money, no pun intended, in question is. When both definitions of gun of involves me taking something from someone else, you're an opera singer, mm-hmm. right? You record, you become famous, you're now worth, let's say, $1 million, and you've got a best-selling CD. If I take that CD and I copy it, how much money do you still have?
$1 million.
So what did I take from you?
Future earnings.
So we'll get there in a second, though. But is taking future earnings considered gezel? Meaning the definition of gezel and ganav or gazlan means you have something, I take it from you, and you are now lessened and I am greater because I just took whatever. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what ganeva is.
Yeah,
that's what gezel is. Bingo.
This isn't that in an immediate way.
We'll get to right. other... There are a few other subtle things here, though. One step at a time. Meaning,
well, but, I mean...
This is only section two. There are a couple more pages.
The halachic definition of ganav and gazel are both talking about tangible things.
Exactly.
Right, so this can't apply to IP.
Bingo! That's the point I'm trying to drive at. Because, by definition, if I copy something from someone else... Yeah, I've got something, but you haven't lost anything, technically. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for stopping in. Your net worth is pretty much is the exact, or at least your net worth isn't really affected by whether or not I copy it. All right?
Yeah.
So in that regard, I mean, I'll, you know, due deference to Moshe, I don't see how copying tapes or whatever would actually be considered, would meet the halakhic criteria of theft. Because you haven't actually taken something from someone else.
Yeah.
All right? All righty. So the next one is something interesting here. Also using a Rambam for this. It's called Sechar Hana'a. This is from Gezeilin Aveda 3.9. Darren, could you please read what we have here, source 7?
Sure. If one stays in residence without the owner's knowledge, if the residence was not made or renting...
Yeah.
He doesn't. What's renting?
Rent. Oh, Lord Almighty. Yeah, it's well known. I can't type, but it didn't come up in a spell check. Not made for renting. Meaning, okay. Let's say a guy has an apartment. It's not set up. He's not renting it out. You just decide to crash there, right? And assuming that you do absolutely no damage, right? You come in with a sleeping bag, sleep on the floor, that's it.
Okay, so he does not have to pay him a fee, even though the residence is normally to rent by itself. Since one benefits but the other does not lose, there's no need for payment.
Mm.
And if the residence is set up to be rented, even though it is not normally rented, the one who resides is obligated to pay a fee since there is a monetary loss incurred.
Interesting here, right? So this is called Zen Nehenev Ze'eino Chaser. This is what happens when you benefit from someone else and that other person doesn't lose. Truth is the Gemara goes through a whole bunch of different scenarios. This is how at least... Rambam, you know, reaches the conclusion here that there's a distinction. That if it's a 100%, I mean, there are opinions in the Gemara that seem to indicate Zenochaser does require some degree of payment. According to Rambam, it seems to be no. That if there's absolutely no monetary loss, then you don't have to pay back. But if there is a monetary loss, you do. But what is that monetary loss? Here, it seems to be more of an opportunity cost. Like, as long as you're crashing in someone's place, you can't have an opportunity cost. Yeah.
What if it's just tzedakah, though? Like, what if you're just doing, like, a good deed for someone that needs it, and it's, like, doing you a favor?
What do you mean?
Like, crash on my floor.
This is without knowledge. I mean, this is when you do it on your own. I mean, you can, you say, oh yeah, sure, stay there. That's fine. Yeah. The question is more of, can you benefit from someone else without them losing it? And do you need to pay them back any money? Right? And Rambam seems to say here that the difference is, if there is a monetary loss incurred, yes. If there isn't, no. Then the question then becomes again, is there in fact a monetary loss when you copy a tape?
What about trespassing?
What?
I mean, if you go according to that, there is a monetary loss, right?
How so?
Well, because in the case of a tape, right? Or in this case, where he says there is a monetary loss if the house is made to be rented, right?
Yeah.
Well, the record is made to be purchased, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, isn't that analogous here?
It's a great point. Here's one way I could counter, though. The apartment is a finite resource, meaning either you're crashing there or it can be rented out. Whereas a CD, I mean, the whole problem with intellectual property is you're duplicating resources. I could take the same song off of one CD and duplicate it millions of times without any degradation in quality, right? But what did that do to the, you know, official record, though? Right, you're not dealing the same thing of either or. You're taking something and you're creating more of it. Right, not so simple.
So I think in that case, like of a CD, I feel like it would totally depend on where your intention was with it. For instance, let's say I had a CD that I listened to all the time. It's my favorite CD. I can't get enough of it. Right, and I have a copy of it in my house, and I love it so much that I like to only keep it in my CD player. And I want another one for my car.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would think that if I go ahead and I burn that CD because I want another copy for my car, I feel like it all depends on, like, if my intention, if I couldn't burn it, if I would have said, well, I'm going to go buy another one for my car and own two, right, then I feel like that would be lost because then by me burning the CD, the person, the recording artist, is losing out on me not buying a second CD. I might be losing people here. I don't know if I'm getting my foot across.
Sure. But if you're in a situation if you did not have the option to copy, you would have actually bought something else. By copying it, you're causing a loss of money.
Exactly. But let's say I couldn't copy it, I would have been like, fine, ugh, it's annoying, but I don't want to buy a second copy, so I'll just transfer it from my house to my car and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Then I feel like, you know, then it probably wouldn't be as bad to copy because I never was planning on buying a second one anyway, so I'm not really costing you anything.
Well, that might be also under, you know, fair use. Like another example would be, a movie that you could download online. You'd never see it in the theaters, but online, all right. You'll go to a site, you'll download it versus, I really want to see this movie, but instead of paying, how much is it to see a movie in the theaters now in New York?
$14.
That is crazy. Right. See, so for $14, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to wait a couple of months. I'll wait a few days and see one of those Handycam things online. Mm-hmm. Right? Maybe wait until it's out on DVD. The question, though, then, is that really a loss of money? That's really, you see, that's the real thing with loss. And there are things in the Gemara that talk about a grama causing a loss to someone. But the problem, again, here isn't the loss. It's negative. It's future not having certain money.
Right.
Which is very different than saying you're now out something that you actually had.
Okay, right.
All right?
Because you never had it.
Now here's, you know, another approach that you'll find in the literature of Hasagat Gvul. And then here we get even trickier. When people, you know, talk about piracy, right, there are many different ways of being involved in this transaction of being, engaging in digital. Let's talk about digital piracy for a second. You've got people who, let's say I buy a CD, right? I can buy a CD, I can rip it to my computer, I put it online, and people take from me. So that's me doing it, right? Mm-hmm. So there's me, the one who bought the CD, me, the one who puts it online. There is also everyone who downloads it, right? What's their role? Because they didn't put it online, they're benefiting from my putting it online. And then if I get it from, you know, a source, let's say download it using a, you know, torrent, and I put it back up. I mean, I think when you download a torrent, it, whatchamacallit, you're a seeder and a leecher at the same time, too. Yeah. So then you're engaged in both sides of things. All right, so we're all literate here. Everyone knows BitTorrent. Hey, look, I was impressed you all know Napster. I would assume you knew Torrent. And the truth is there were different systems set up in terms of how they work. The reason why Napster got shut down was because... Right, because it all went through a centralized server. The other ones like Kazaa, Morpheus, Grokster were more spidered out. So there was no central place where, you know, the RIAA basically said, at any given moment, pirated material or copyright material is on Napster servers. And that's what took him out. But everything else, it's all distributed. See, this is what you learn in cheer. Right. So point being, right, would you think there might be a difference, halakhically, between giving and receiving? Right? Even if you want to say, you know, I'm going to buy it, maybe it's bad that I buy it and then I distribute it, because that's bad. And we'll see about if that works. But what about any other engagement? Do you think that might matter in terms of what part of, you know, the whole illegal downloading thing might affect it halakhically? Any thoughts?
Well, clearly in U.S. law, it does matter. So.
Well, yeah. Although it seems in U.S. laws, it also matters by volume. Although U.S. law is really weird with that. You know, because they'll, like, do these John Doe things based on an IP address for, like, downloading one or two songs. And they tend to enforce it more for the big ones. But anyway, one of the issues that could come up with this, with the distributing, is something called Hasagat Gavul, which literally means encroaching on a border, and it kind of, no pun intended, does get extended in Jewish law or understanding. But so first, let's do the big one. Lar, could you read source number 8? This is Devarim 19:14.
Do not move your neighbor's boundary stone set up by your predecessors and the inheritance you receive in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess.
Right, so Hasagat Gvul, biblically, just means... if you have you've got a neighbor, you're not allowed to move your boundary line to basically take more land. Could you do source number 9? And this is how the Sifrei, rabbinic text, also Tannaitic era, sort of extrapolates this prohibition.
Okay, so do not move your neighbor's boundaries, but as it is not already be, but it has not, but as it not already
been.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I couldn't figure that out.
No. Look, unless it's the Babylonian Talmud where I copy and paste,
no,
or the like Sifri's, I had to write myself. That's my bad.
Okay.
Bin said.
So it's, but has it not already?
Yeah.
Okay. But has it not already been said, do not steal? What does do not move your neighbor's boundary come to teach us? To teach us that whoever uproots the border of his fellow violates two prohibitions.
Okay. If you move the boundary, you are considered to have stolen. Mm-hmm. So why does it say it twice? Oh, because you actually violate two prohibitions.
It is possible that this also applies outside of the land of Israel. Therefore, it comes to teach, in your inheritance which you receive, in Israel one violates two prohibitions. Outside of Israel, one only violates one prohibition. If one moves the boundaries, he only violates theft.
Right. All right, so moving boundaries is considered bad. I mean, it's effectively like the only way you could really steal land. But that's technically what Hasagat Gvul means, right? Moving, you know, or encroaching the borders. Mm-hmm. Where it gets into halacha is Gemar Bar Batra 21b has a few instances about earning livelihood or competition. And you'll see in a bit how this, you know, gets extended. Rav Huna said, if a resident of an alley sets up a handmill, and another resident of an alley wants to set up one next to him, the first has a right to stop him, because he can say to him, quote, you are interfering with my livelihood. May we say that this view is supported by the following? Fishing nets must be kept away from the hiding place of a fish, which has been spotted by another fisherman, the full length of a fish's swim. And how much is this? Rabba, the son of Rav Huna, says, a parsing. Fishes are different because they look about for food. Hence the fisherman, who knows where the hole is, places bait within the fish's swim, and if another does this, he is poaching on the preserves of the first. But this cannot be said of one who sets up an opposition mill. So this very short passage here, and do you want to do the next paragraph here because it gets in a little more detail, turns into a basis for basically laws of Jewish competition, where someone invests money to set up a certain business, you cannot then go and encroach and benefit off of the other person's work. So the difference with, say, fish is, since there's a cost, sort of say an initial investment of laying out bait, you can't come in and then start fishing there because you're benefiting from the guy's, you know, bait. I'll say just very briefly, practically, Hasagat Gvul has been applied very selectively when someone opens up a shop too close to someone else and saying, it's like, oh, you're not allowed to compete, you're not allowed to compete. And there are other paragraphs here about are you or are you not allowed to set up a competitive business next to someone else. So I'll just read through this quickly. An objection was raised against Rav Huna from the following: a man may open a shop next to another man's shop or a bath next to another man's bath, and the latter cannot object because he can say to him, I do what I like in my property and you do what you like in yours. On this point, there is a difference of opinion among Tanaim, meaning among the earlier rabbis in the rabbinic period, they actually argued on this point. As appears from the following braita, the residents of an alley can prevent one another from bringing in a tailor, a tanner, or a teacher, or any other craftsman, but cannot prevent another from setting up an opposition. Meaning, as a collective, you can say we don't want certain people to set up shop, but once one is there, you can't prevent someone else from coming in. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, however, says that one may prevent another. And then there's a discussion about whether one from one town can prevent from another town, that's left unresolved. So what in the world does this have to do with piracy? So here we turn to Chatam Sofer. The translation here is from Rabbi Israel Schneider, from an article, Jewish Law and Copyright, from Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, otherwise known as the RJJ Journal. It says, if the case is so, that limited protection is granted for the printers of other texts already in the public domain, so much more so for one who created a new entity. For example, the consummate scholar, Rabbi Wolf Heidenheim, who spent countless hours in the editing and translating of the Piyutim, and why should others profit from his creativity? Our case can be compared to the case of the fisherman who, by means of his actions, caused the gathering of the fish. Analogy is, someone puts in a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of work to put out a creative material. You are now benefiting or encroaching on his ability or his livelihood to get money out of this. What do you think about this argument? Do you think the case... Well, first off, do you understand the two cases? If not, we can go over those. And if not... All right. So one is the case of the fisherman, right? You put bait down. According to the Gemara, you have to give a certain distance but when you fish so that you are not benefiting or encroaching on the bait that was placed by the fisherman. Sure. Here the analogy seems to be, well, either, I guess, duplication of some form of material, someone already put in the effort, you are not allowed to encroach on what this person has already done. Mm-hmm. Right? So what do you think? Are these analogous? Are these not analogous? Now keep in mind, you can understand why Chatam Sofer and others want to have some set of copyright law. Like, we can understand the social need for it, right? But the question is, do you think the analogy works on a halachic, logical, legal level? Why or why not? Dan? Any thoughts?
I don't see why, but...
So the second case is saying that you're not allowed to, if, you know, I do something creative, you're not allowed to cop, like, I'm just making sure I understand what it's bringing to say. I understand the fish.
Yeah.
The second one is saying about if I do something creative, you can't use that, you can't make money off of that creative.
Ah, well, so you just raised an interesting point there. I mean, you threw in two words that haven't been mentioned before, mm-hmm. specifically make money. Mm-hmm. Meaning, could there be a difference between me downloading an MP3 and then me downloading an MP3 and then reselling it. Right? Mm-hmm. Think there could be a difference here. I mean, you may say that giving it away for free, like on a torrent site, like is in fact like selling it, and so you're, because you're setting up an alternate, you know, way of like collecting stuff. But
it just doesn't seem the same as the fish, because the fish is a tangible thing. You physically take the fish. You take the guy's fish, right? The fish is going to swim to get this guy's bait. But then he sees yours on the way, so he takes that instead.
Not only that, but even though fish do in fact reproduce, I think you're perfect. You know, when you said it's a tangible thing, MP3s are not. Right? there's a finite supply of fish. No matter what people say, there are plenty of fish in the sea. There still is a finite number. Things like MP3s could be, again, duplicated.
Infinitely copied.
Mm-hmm. Makes it much, and same thing with, you know, even photocopies of material, although you'll have some degradation in quality. But in terms of, like, redistributing it, also in terms of profiting off of someone else's work, let me throw in another problem that we're going to see in the next one, in the final section. When we talk about the fish, how many parties are really involved?
Two.
Two. When you talk about downloading stuff online, how many people are we talking about?
Unknown.
Like it could be infinite.
Exactly. The people from whom you're really deriving benefit, is it necessarily the author, or is it the person that you're actually bringing it, getting it from? Example, let's say I've got a book, and let's say you want to photocopy the book. Right? All right, fine, so take the book and photocopy it. Who's really giving you that benefit? Is it between the author and you, or is it me? I purchased the book legally, right? Let's forget about what individual, I mean, right? So why not? Like, go ahead. You're not doing it. Or, you know, I download stuff online. I'm not downloading the stuff from the artist. I'm downloading it from whoever put it online. The artist has nothing to do with it, right? Maybe the artist got it, you know, the person purchased it. Maybe he didn't. But the artist doesn't really enter into it.
Is the Chatam Sofer talking about books?
Well, yes, because other stuff didn't exist.
Right, but you're just making the relation.
Right, because the intellectual property is still kind of the same. The logic stays the same in terms of respecting the creative works of others.
Yeah, I mean, just because books also are tangible.
Books are tangible, but you can, you know, certainly copy and, you know, do some reproducing. Right, you can pass stuff off, you know, on your own. Once you've got like any form of mimeograph, you know, if you, anyone remember the carbon ones? Right. Oh, so I know this is dating myself, but like before, you know, photocopy machines were
like microfiche.
No, not even microfiche. These were, how to put this? There was this like metallic bin. And you put in toner, like you fed it in manual, it smelt to high heaven. And you put in this...
Is that what they use for to get your credit card? You know, when the...
Carbon paper?
Yes, the carbon thing. And they would just, like, crank this thing out, and that would send out these, like, blue... Oh, man, or, like, not even a blue-purple thing.
Like a sheet, right?
Yeah, and it, like, smelled, you know... All right. Point is, you're youngins. Anyway... So final section here of something that comes up where people want to say, well, actually, you know, you do have, you know, there is something that's involved here. And that's at least, you know, when you purchase something, you know, by way of CD, by way of anything, it says, you know, you can't do something with this. There's somehow part of the transaction, they're limiting your rights. Now, at this point here, we're not talking about your ability to download because, you know, I can, you know, if I download from Microsoft Office, I can say, well, I entered into no such agreement. Like, I don't care, right? But if you buy it, what can you do with your own work? Because the example I gave with the book is like, well, you're getting my book, right? So what does the original author have to do with it? But there's something in there that says, you know, all rights reserved, you know, unauthorized duplication prohibited without express consent. Does that matter halakhically? Let's talk about it. Yeah. Take source 12, what I have 12 here, as Nidarim 11a.
Rabbi Meir said, any condition not like the condition of the sons of Gad and Reuben are not valid conditions.
Okay, so now, some of you might not know what exactly is this condition. So for this, we go back to the Bible. Continue down with Numbers 32, 20 to 23.
Then Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will arm yourselves before the Lord for battle, and if all of you who are armed cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven his enemies out before him, then when the land is subdued before the Lord, you may return and be free from your obligation to the Lord and to Israel. And this land will be your possession before the Lord. Sorry. But if you fail to do this, you will be sinning against the Lord, and you may be sure that your sin will find you out.
Does anyone remember the context before we talk about this a bit?
Yeah, it was the whole thing about Reuven, Gad, and Chassim, and Manasseh. They were allowed to, they had to fight for the land of Israel before wanting to settle in the Yardian, I think.
Exactly. So you had a couple of tribes that didn't want to cross over. They said, hey, things are pretty good right here. Can we stay put? So they made a deal with Moshe. Now, I underlined here in the English and in the Hebrew the operative parts of this. In Hebrew, it is called a tenai kaful, which means a doubled condition. And what makes it a doubled condition is, first, if you will do this. All right, that's your normal condition, right? That's what the definition of a condition is. Something is conditional, if. But what makes it a kaful is that second underline. But if you fail to do this, when you say, what happens when you don't actually meet the terms of this agreement? It's something that many, many agreements would be much better off if you had them in. When you make explicit, here's what you're supposed to do. And if you don't do this, here's what the consequence is. Right? Think about contracts, just how much simpler life would be if you had both of them. So according to Rav Meir and Halacha, you need to have a tenai kaful, a doublet explicitly stated, not only what happens if the term is met, but also what happens if the term is not met. That is a tenai kaful. Now when you buy something from a store, not only is it not explicit that you're buying it on such a condition, but in Jewish law at least, unless you actually have it said, doing so, like, here's what you do, you're buying this on this such and such a condition, and if this condition is broken, you need to have some sort of thing. Well, what happens if that condition is broken? And normal, I mean, we don't do that today for most contracts. I mean, in Jewish contracts, you know, kind of important, but yeah, right? So that part is missing. Laura, could you finish us off here with somewhat of a related issue, and we'll see if this is parallel too, about a conditional transaction. This is a Gemara in Bava Metzia 78b.
Rav Shimon ben Eleazar said on Rav Meir's authority, if one gives a dinar to a poor man to buy a shirt, he may not buy a cloak therewith. To buy a cloak, he must not buy a shirt, because he disregards the donor's desire. But perhaps there it is different, because he may fall under suspicion. For people may say, so-and-so promised to buy a shirt for that poor man, and he has not bought it. Or, so-and-so promised to buy a cloak for that poor man, and he has not bought it. If so, it should state, because he may be suspected. Why state, because he disregards the donor's desire? This proves that it is essentially because he makes a change, and he who disregards the owner's desire is called a robber.
Yeah, so here you've got, and this is actually a really important Gemara for any nonprofit organization, right?
Just thinking about it.
Yeah, well, seriously, because, I mean, Yale's actually, you know, came out. It was one of the critiques they had with Yale, with the, I think the president is stepping down about money going to places not for donor intent. So according to this Gemara, someone donates money for a specific cause, doing something, kol hamavir al-da'at shel ba'al habayit nikra gazlan. If he gives you money for a certain purpose, and you don't use it for that purpose, you are called a thief, using that word gezel again, right? So, our case parallel? Because here, you're talking about, I'm allowed, or like somehow, I give you money to do something, you're supposed to do it that way. But maybe this could apply for actual purchasing. Does that work? Right? Because normally, something, you either have you only have usually one owner at a time, unless you have explicit stated joint ownership. Jewish law does recognize joint ownership called shituf. Aside from that, right, I have a pen. I give it to you, you have the pen. Here you have a case where I give you something, and yet somehow I retain certain rights to it in a weird way. Almost as if I've given it on condition, right? Do you think there's a difference here between, I mean, the main difference that we're talking about here, I mean, there's one that is apparent, is that here we're talking about a case of charity versus a case of commerce. Do you think that makes a difference? And if so, why or why not? Well, not if so, why not? That doesn't make sense, but, you know, it's clear that it's a different case, right? But it is a case where the person who's giving over something retains a certain degree of what we call achrayut, some, you know, element of ownership there. Because he's also called ba'al habayit. He's called head of the household, not just the notin. Like, there still is some sense of ownership over this money, right? So let's say in any other transaction, does the seller have a right to retain that?
I would think so. I don't see what the difference would be, just off the top of my head. Between charity and a regular sale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm giving you this, just like in charity, I'm giving you this money on condition that you go buy a shirt. or I'm selling you this product on condition that you don't photocopy it and give it to other people.
Right, but then wouldn't that, if you're saying that it's done with a certain, so there are two issues there. One is a matter of like I'll deny, which is I'm doing this on a condition. Another thing, I'm doing this al minat, which sounds like a condition. In fact, some people will say it's, you know, kind of the same, but here it's hanotin dinar la'ani likach lo chiluk, right? It's saying, I'm doing this to you for a specific purpose, right? Meaning, in that sale, right, you and I would both know that here is, you know, what's going on. The, you know, I let, you know, someone's probably say, here's a dollar, go get yourself food, right? So the only reason why I'm giving you this money is so that you go get yourself food. If you go ahead and not give yourself food, then the transaction would be flawed simply because I did it when I gave you this money. There was a certain clear, defined intent. And by you accepting it, then, you know, you agreed. Mm-hmm. When I go to a store and I buy something, is that necessarily made explicit? Now, unless the cashier register asks you, at that time of transaction, well, I'm, you know, we're selling you this, but only under blah, blah, blah conditions. Maybe, let's say you don't. Let's say in your head, like, nope, I don't agree with this at all. You still keep, well.
What if the condition is inside the product? Like, if it's on a CD?
Well, that's, then you couldn't possibly have read it then. Now, could you have?
Oh, and you actually got it.
At the point of sale, was there any explanation of, like, here's what your sale is contingent upon? And the answer is no, or at least to no music store I've been to.
Right.
Although, in fairness, I have not actually set foot in a music store in a really, really long time. Is that, yeah, it's, yeah.
Nobody goes to those anymore.
Well, right. I mean, truth is iTunes, you know, did a lot for that.
Yeah, but
more legally.
You do accept an agreement. Like, there's a lot of...
Yeah, and you pay for stuff on iTunes.
Yeah.
You know, and there are also ways of listening to music for free, unless, like,
right,
Spotify.
But like, the terms of agreement that you click and agree to before you can even buy anything on iTunes, I mean, I've got to, I cannot say for a fact, but I've got to assume that it says in there that you're not going to duplicate or replicate anything.
Right, so then that gets into more complicated issues of what are the halachic implications of the EULA, which stands for End User License Agreement. And the truth is, even in American law, the actual, like, force of law of a EULA is not as strong as you'd think.
What, you mean, like, how they enforce it?
Exactly. Right? And then, I mean,
I would imagine they only enforce it if it was on a large scale. Like, they're not...
Yeah, I don't even know how enforceable some are. I know not everyone has been. Like, there are problems there. I also came up, like, years back, two ways of getting around them. One, get yourself completely plastered before hitting OK. So then, and have video proof that you entered into this agreement while drunk. Two, you can get a 5-year-old to click OK or hit the space bar, right? And it thinks you've entered into the agreement, but you yourself haven't. The kid did, right? And those are just two things that I came up with. People smarter than I am. What?
That doesn't seem kosher to me.
Yeah.
As a musician, I'm kind of just...
Well, yeah, this is what... this is why you actually spend a lot of years in yeshiva. You think of, like, all these wacky cases, like, does this work, does that work? And the truth is, they do this in law school, too.
Right, but it's not the right thing to do.
So right thing to do is a separate question. And most people will tell you not to. Exactly. This is only... Pure letter of the law, what does halacha have to say about intellectual property? It is my opinion, it really doesn't, because it didn't really exist. There was some cognition, and you have some homiletic statements behind it, but not real law. I'll share one story. There was a YU Rosh Yeshiva, who was someone that I felt I could trust with this type of question, because I knew he had expertise in the technical field. And I figured, when I first put this together, he's the one, you know, I need to ask. And I said, look, I'm putting all these sources together. I'm trying to find an Iser, trying to find where I could say it's biblically or rabbinically prohibited, and here's why. And nothing works. Like, everything I'm looking at, it doesn't fit. And he said, if we had the Sanhedrin, if we had the Jewish court around today, I'm sure they would say it was Usser. And I looked at him and I said, oh, so basically it's Mutter. Because if you're saying that if we had the court, then they would legislate, means nothing on the books works.
There's nothing now.
Right? Now, again, that also means, you know, to say the disclaimer at the very beginning, that's just within the Jewish system itself. You want to start going with Dina de Malchuta Dina, That's a much longer discussion, but that is a way that people do rely on to outlaw, you know, saying Jewish law prohibits it because of Dina de Mahu de Dina. I consider it a cop-out, but it still works. Like, to give an example, when I was, you know, in high school, like many high school kids, really didn't like getting up for Minyan. And, you know, knowing, you know, a bit of halacha, there happens to be, like, no place where it says you have to daven with a Minyan. Like, Rambam says, if you don't daven with a minyan, you're a bad neighbor, bad this, and goes off for a while. But he never uses that term chiyuv. You're obligated. So my dad would, you know, try to wake me up, and I'd say, where does the Rambam say you have to go to minyan? You know, where does the Torah say you have to go to minyan? And he says, kibudav, now get out of bed. You know, so it's a cop-out, because it's like, honor your father, meaning it has, the end result is the same. You have to get up and go to minyan from a different law, even though, yes, there's nothing on the books, but that doesn't... Yeah, it's
make it okay.
Exactly. But it is a fascinating thing because intuitively, people want there to be a straight law. Because ethically, I think people know that the piracy is wrong. Benefiting from piracy is wrong. Not to say that that stops people from doing it, right? It's a weird way. Like, people will feel don't feel bad about doing it, but they'd feel bad about saying it's completely okay. Like, because they realize there's something strange about that.
I mean, on the other side of the coin, like, as a musician, like, you feel bad about it when you are the one getting pirated from. Like,
right.
That, I mean, I don't know if that raises more awareness on the side of, like, oh, it doesn't seem like I'm affecting anyone's life doing this. But, like, on the other side, like, yes, you are hurting somebody, and that's...
People,
there's got to be a law about that.
Well, like, the problem is that since it is indirect, you know, it's hard to, you know, really see what that is.
Right. I mean, I get it. It's not tangible. It's not enough. I get it. It's not like a fish. It's not like a book. Like, it's not as tangible as these examples. But at the same time, like, it's like what you're saying. Like, there is, like, this hargasha that it's just not. It's not kosher to do it.
Does anyone... Oh, you guys certainly... Wait, maybe you would. Anyone here remember the TV show What's Happening? Okay. It was... all right. Raj, Rerun, and Dwayne. Never mind. So there was an episode dedicated to them bootlegging a Doobie Brothers concert. And while they're, like, in the front row dancing... Like, this massive tape recorder and microphone falls out of the guy's jacket. Which, look for it on YouTube, of, like, What's Happening bootleg. It's a hilarious clip today because it's so antiquated. Like, the tape recorder is about the size of this paper. You know, and now we're, like, recording digitally on this. And they go through the thing about, like, how bad bootlegging is. You know, and this was just even recording a live show. Yeah. You know, that wasn't even for things. So, you know, the people in the industry, you know, were definitely... And I know there aren't, because there are a whole bunch of other, you know, issues behind it. But it is important. And look, even when the rabbis themselves tried to struggle with it, you know, they recognized, you know, on a few issues. One, if you had a monopoly, that would be bad for the dissemination of Torah. On the other hand, if you take away the creative incentive, people just wouldn't do it. Now, you could argue for things like music. Great, so we don't have another, you know, boy band. We can live. When, you know, it took a lot of effort to really bring stuff to the masses, like, say, you know, mass-producing Gemaras, mass-producing Rambam, or any other Sefer, and you want people to mass-produce it, and you want it to get out there, then you're going to be a little bit more careful about protecting people's rights. I think people, in coming up with Yisurim, might have extended halacha more than it, you know, like, you could argue, say, like, well, this isn't really halacha, this is something you're making. Like, you could see why people wanted to come up with those isurim. Again, because intuitively you want it to be on the books that it's not okay to take someone else's intellectual property and to redistribute it. Even though I can't find you a specific isur for it, and if anyone can come up with a better one, I'd love to hear the argument about why and how exactly does it fit. And to view it as critically as you view any other halacha, although some people view things selectively critically, but you know what I mean. But, you know, again, this isn't to say that you can go ahead, and, you know, Dina de Mahuta, you know, still applies, but you just have to go spend your time figuring out American copyright law. And get back to me in a couple years if you do that. So have a great week.